Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and EJ.
Guys, keep calm and read your tickets. EJ, we're using the Anna Karenina method here. Yes, PJ.
Hello there.
I am the Dean, and we are the Books Boys. This is the Books Boys show. Get it, buy it, books.
Books.
And PJ, I heard it's the 2-year anniversary.
Oh, hey!
There we go. Woo!
It's 2 years. Can you believe it?
I didn't think we'd make it this far.
No, I didn't think so. And it's episode 25, right? I keep thinking it's 24, but it's kind of 25. Okay.
Yes.
That is mad. That's so we're like another, you know, so we're just a quarter of a hundred. Alone, that is amazing. So let's see if we can make 100 episodes, because that would be in 2 years. In 6 years' time, we can celebrate the 100th episode.
Yeah, look, if we're still alive, you know, we'll make 100. So.
Exactly, yeah. I'm very amused because I'm just thinking about all the book recommendations. And if you're going to keep doing stuff like Audrey Hepburn picture books.
I'm out of ideas already. Like, today's the last time I can do a recommendation. But John Millet Laffer is back from his strike. He's got his pay rise.
Oh,
he's a big smiley fellow.
What pay rise? He's the best. He's the best paid out of all.
And just for the anniversary, Bufanda Boys making a comeback. I got my Bufanda.
Yeah, Bufanda Boys. I haven't seen them in a while.
There we go.
Good Lord.
We got everything ready.
And tis a question that's been bothering me, Dean. One singular, unique question. Books, what's it all about? 2 years.
Did we ever figure it out?
2 years, you know, the amount of times I've been in the toiletry section, pharmacies, you know, the whole shebang, trying to look for Julius Caesar. Oh, by the way, Dean, is this a holiday?
Maybe it is a holiday. I don't know. Hence home, you idle creatures.
Well, I've been trying to look for the old shaker's spear, but I could only shake the toilet roll so much and nothing I could find. I think books are something like maybe something related to bookworms, right? So it's a type of insect, and you read poems under wings or something like that.
It makes sense.
I don't
know.
I'm getting into the very metaphysical grounds here. If you guys have any clarity regarding books, just tell us what it's all about.
Well,
and plus, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, just thinking like, yeah, plus just send us some of these things. Send us some of these magical books and magical.
We actually love it when people send us books. And we love it when people call into the show to talk about their books. And you can connect with us on Instagram and all the other places, booksboys.com, email us, booksboys@hotmail.com, whatever you want. But PJ, it's time to introduce this month's sponsor. We're sponsored by the Association for Keeping Calm and Reading Your Dickens. And they've sent us this delightful advertisement. Listeners, were you about to scream and yell at your loved ones? Or go out into the street and protest and riot? Or were you just going to smash and break things in your home? Stop! Keep calm and read your Dickens. There we go. The Association for Keeping Calm and Reading Your Dickens. So, oh, what's this? They've sent us a second one.
A second one?
Listeners, were you about to watch that sports game? or use some tools and build things. Where are you going to go to lunch, Marty? Stop! Keep calm and read your Dickens. Paid for by the Association for Keeping Calm and Reading Your Dickens. There we go, our good friends. Nice voice that guy has as well.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, yeah, I mean, it's very central, I must say. And that's a very Dickensian saxophone player. Yeah. Nice. Nice.
By the way, just before we get stuck into the books we're reading, we have a quick hello.
Hi, Dean. Hi, PJ. This is Anne here, Anne Wedgwood. Just calling to congratulate you on 2 years of Books Boys. I love your podcast and it's been great fun to be on them. Thanks so much for inviting me and well done again for your 2 years. Bye.
Ah, oh, thanks, Anne. That's lovely. Send a message.
Hope we don't have any more call-ins or crazy interruptions on the show. We can just get down to some serious book talking, you know?
I think so. And it should be all very serious, you know, very academic, very
from
dry.
Now on, yeah, nothing but serious books. And another party horn's back. Would you believe it?
And so let's talk about books. What are the books that thou hast been reading this month?
Well, got a pile of them here. So I started out, this is not the copy I read. My copy got abandoned in Spain, but I had a second copy. Doña Perfecta.
Oh, I had that copy as well. Actually, I had two copies too, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Doña Perfecta by Benito Pérez Galdós.
No, I did this in the wrong order, I suppose, because this one came out a year or two before Marianella, which we reviewed on the last episode, which I didn't realize before I read them. But
just like yourself, I also first read Marianella, and then Doña Perfecta was maybe my second or third Galdós book. Just to remind you listeners, if you don't know already, Galdós is the Spanish equivalent of Dickens, being the primary realist author in Spain in the 19th century. Together with Clarín, who Dean does not seem to appreciate so much, apart from a few short stories. So, Doña Perfecta, what did you think?
I liked it, but not as much as Marianella. So that's the summary.
It wasn't maybe as melodramatic.
It was not quite as melodramatic. That's it. We're getting the catchphrases in. There was no holidays. Yeah. There was no melodramas. There was no dark lit. I don't know. It's all
no dark lit.
They didn't keep calm and read their Dickens. I don't know. So there's a joke I like very near the beginning of the book. Actually, it's the best bit of the book. There's one chap. He's a minor character called Lycurgus, and the chap calls him Solon, and that's funny because Lycurgus was a Spartan lawmaker, and Solon was an Athenian lawmaker. So he gets his name mixed up, and he switches him out to the Athenian one. So I thought that was funny.
That's such a just like insider joke, isn't it? By the way, Galdós was a really hardcore classicist. You know, he actually, before he started writing novels, he really wrote down tons and tons of pages of Greek and Latin style poetry just so he can improve his writing. So I don't think he was like trying to write anything too serious, but he kind of seemed to have like, he kind of thought of writing like as a physical practice, like even that you would just practice writing like the classical authors until you last wrote the classics. So yeah, he would be an intellectual chap indeed. Well, what about the story?
The story, right. I'll give you the quick version, okay? So this is chap Pepe. Now, basically what happens is he's going to marry Rosario. And the way they figure this out is he is essentially told by his dad, go visit your cousins. Your aunt is Doña Perfecta and your cousin Rosario. So off he goes, and the idea is that they've kind of done an arranged marriage between the two branches of the family, and for whatever reason, you know, among the parents. So he goes off and he hangs out with them for a while, and they are living in Villa Horrenda. And you know, off he goes. And they kind of have this thing where they don't like him. Like they decide that he's a non-believer, that he's an atheist, but he denies it. And it's never really clear like whether he is or not. You know, he just denies it when they confront him with this. But one of the big themes in this book is your more metropolitan modern Madrid lifestyle, which they accuse yeah. him of being from. And they keep saying, oh, you can't go out without your dukes and your duchesses and all your pantry and your theater shows. And we're just a simple little, you know, backwards kind of religious town. And they're very, very deeply religious. But he says the town is just full of bandits and trash people.
Right. So again, it's that kind of dialectic between the kind of non-believer metropolitan progressive versus yes. the believer village. Well, conservative.
But there's this idea as well that basically the town's full of bandits and Doña Perfecta might be the only real upstanding person in it anyway. So it's kind of built on a myth to begin with, you know. But eventually they're hanging out as a family and it starts out okay, but it goes downhill quickly. But he does eventually tell his cousin, you know, look, I actually came here specifically to marry you. And luckily I do like you, so like that's grand, and she likes him back. It's not a story where they don't want the arranged marriage. They're both quite happy with it. And the person who's not happy with it is Doña Perfecta, the aunt. She develops this sham where she pretends that she's always helping, and she's essentially just gaslighting him the whole time, like pretending that she's really trying to get everything to work. But actually, she's the one creating a lot of obstacles for him. And, you know, that her daughter is sick and he can't see her for like days and days and days at a time, you know. And he's like, you're not letting me see her. Like, I could just go and chat to her. Like, you're the one putting the obstacles in the way, you know. And it turns out that she maybe has a mental illness. They tell her that she's local, right? That she's crazy. But he doubts it, you know, and it's not really clear if she is or not. But he's always respectful to her. You know, he always calls her dear aunt, you know, querida tía, the whole time. She keeps up a pretense for a long time, but eventually she does drop it. And eventually she says, maybe I've done some deceptions, but, you know, even God has to do deceptions. This is religious, like, I'm doing good work, you know, I'm doing this kind of things that God would do to stop this atheist and this non-believer from marrying my daughter. Where it loses me is it's this big, long sequence. He kind of follows the Anna Karenina method a little bit. In a short book where there's just this big long sequence of them arguing back and forward and like discussing religion and things, you know. And I'm like, okay, guys, let's get the story moving a wee bit here. We've been 20 pages on this, you know. And there's a lot of going round in circles, like, but what about her mother? I am her mother. It's like, yeah, so I'm gonna marry her. It's like, but what about her mother? It's like, yeah, 10 pages later, we're still on this,
you know. Okay. Let me think about this. So, you know, that's an interesting parallel to old Pere Gorio, because he talks about the duties of a father and am I not a father? Mm. But I think the reason why maybe you're not liking it so much is because Pere Gorio, you have a lot of sympathy for him in Balzac's novel. But here, Doña Perfecta, she's the antagonist, right? So you don't really have any... Yeah, I know what you mean. You don't have any sympathy for her being a mother because you should feel she was being deceptive. Gorio wasn't being deceptive. Yeah. Everyone was deceiving him, so it's very different. But I remember when I was reading that again, I was reading Love, Galdós when I was a teenager, actually. And I remember it making an impact with me anyway, the whole novel. And really, what stayed with me more than anything was a setting for some reason in the story. I really have this image of this kind of, I don't know, for some reason, this kind of like somewhat dark, misty autumn Spanish town and like everything kind of going against the protagonist. So it's interesting they're saying the story because I kind of forgot the story. But for me, it's like almost this Western kind of story of like going against the one person who's rational.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, that's the impression I was left with. But it made an impact with me.
It starts like that. It changes because the mother, Doña Perfecta, the aunt, actually accuses him of having manipulated the whole time against her.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think a soldier arrives and they're going to take the town, try to clear out the bandits, and he befriends the soldier. So she says, like, I'm not just fighting my nephew, I'm fighting the whole town. He's representing the government from Madrid, the army, you know, like she feels like this nephew all of a sudden is the authority, you know. And he's coming to steal her kid away. But it's so strange because this is a marriage that she has requested that both participants are happy with. You know, she's the only person who's not happy. And she puts all these obstacles and they have all these big fights and she has the girl locked away. And at one point he sneaks in to see his betrothed and it's a very weird scene where she unlocks like a secret door and takes him in and says, oh, this is going to be so secret. Look at this secret cabinet. And they go into like a dark, damp room. It's like a statue of Jesus. And she makes him like kiss his feet or something. Pretty weird.
Oh, I think I recall that. Yeah. Then
and
some
the mother's like, defile the statue.
But I feel like this story could be very well adapted into a horror movie.
Yeah, maybe.
In that sense of like the manipulative mother. You know, interestingly mentioned Anna Karenina methods. You know, Anna Karenina was written, I think, just was being written during the time Donnie Perfecto was released. But War and Peace was had been released a few years before. And, you know, Dostoevsky was already, you know, all that kind of movement of big realist authors telling a minor story and really like Flaubert, for example, like really projecting their philosophy of religion, society, of morality, whatever. You know, maybe Galdós, being very young here, one of his early novels, was perhaps influenced by that idea of like, yeah, coming up. I think his idea is the rural versus the urban. Remember I told you last month, we've mentioned Galdós a few times. He grew up in the same island. I grew up in Gran Canaria, but he left very soon, I think at 18, and he just kind of never came back. He stayed in Madrid. He must have been very conflicted, though. He must have seen that kind of rural lifestyle and not really agree with it. He's very much an urban personality, Galdós. So
yeah.
He's obviously, in some sense, that village, even though it's not the Canary Islands, probably is very much based in what he saw.
Yeah,
at least
maybe
in the inland of the of Gran Canaria. So it's very interesting, yeah.
It could be. But I like it. And I like her kind of gaslighting. She keeps saying, I'm so humble and you know, full of humiliation.
Yeah.
And she plays the victim. But really, there's a non-problem. And she's the only one causing a problem, you know?
And I know I'm going on a bit about like the history of literature here. But I just want to say that this hypocrisy of religious people becomes even way more dominant in Spanish naturalism. And in like Generación de 98, the 98
right.
generation, and authors like Miguel de Unamuno, Valle Inclán, or Pío Baroja, that
sure.
would have read Galdós as children or young adults and then written their own things. So he's just starring in that big criticism of religion.
And Mireia and I did a review of a Valle Inclán play on our Patreon, and you're going to hear a little about Unamuno in a few minutes, so...
Oh, so there you go. We're going very Spanish here.
Yeah.
But not quite as Marianella dramatic as you wanted to.
Not quite. There's one dramatic bit I like, right? And this is, you know, I love this in all the English Victorian novels as well.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
a chapter called The Confession and the girl's praying to God. And she decides that she must be doing something wrong to have caused all this drama. And she's like, you know, I don't know, God, you know, why don't you just kill me, God? Strike me down. Like, you know, I'm completely causing
dramatic.
All these problems, you know? And it's bringing in that Marianella drama that we love there. And she does this kind of thing a lot. And at one point she's going crazy and he says to her, like, we've got to cure you. And she says, no, don't cure me. I want to go crazy because I'm crazy for your love. So like, I don't care if I lose my mind and I end up dying as long as I do it for you. And he's like, I don't want you to die. And she's like, yes, yes.
Of course you love that.
So I love all that kind of stuff, yeah. But it does get a bit actually towards the end when like the military kind of have to come
yeah,
in. And I don't
that.
Want to give
yeah.
any spoilers, but it all...
I thought it was very much of a... I thought it was very much of a thriller, especially for the time. Not that I ever... I don't find classic novels really much of a thriller usually, but I thought this novel had me gripped. Like Gorio, but Gorio had me emotionally gripped. I thought, just like you said, there was a bit of an adventure element. It's still one of my favorite Galdós novels, although Marianella is my favorite. So the first one I read, but Donnie Perfecto, like,
yeah,
this is still his romantic period, but he's obviously realism is coming
but
more.
I've
so
got
I
the
like
quote here. He says, my, it's not just my nephew. My nephew is the government, the brigadier, the new mayor, the new judge. You know, he is everything in the town. He's not.
Yeah. It's like a metaphor. I like it. Yeah. Cool.
So that's
nice.
That's the first one.
Doña Perfecta.
So what I'll say is, just before we get into any more, let's take 2 minutes to recap a little bit. PJ, you're back in Spain, but you've been whizzing off to Germany and Spain and all sorts, right?
Yes, and I'm going back to Germany again now. So the next episode will be in Germany.
We're
I've been living la vida loca, das verrückte Leben, and Yeah, so we were talking about Dean and I, like, you know, all this kind of like pay us for Patreon, and I suppose we have enough money for flights.
Well,
if you want us to
read
even
more, don't tell them that. Don't tell them we have enough. We're struggling, desperately.
Very much.
And in that kind of news, I visited Spain this month, and I visited Spain during the National Day of Hispanidad. I was in Santiago de Compostela. I saw the pilgrims come to the cathedral. I went to Zaragoza during their regional day and had big street parties. I saw lots of bands. I went to the theater. I saw a Vijay Inclán play performed,
nice.
Cabeza del Dragón. You know, I did lots of nice things. I was also in Vigo. I was in Madrid, of course, in El Retiro in the park. Where else did I go? Sevilla also. I traveled around a lot. So as we were saying, guys, please go to patreon.com/booksboys and pay $3 because we really need your money.
We're struggling to pay the bills because we're never at home, right? That's
what
kind of
I was going to say, right? It's like, you know, if they don't sign up, maybe we can't do trips next year. And I was like, well, actually, no, I've already planned some trips next year. But
and I believe you've been purchasing some very, very vital items, Dean. Very,
you saw my £50 that I spent on a set of hairbrushes, vintage hairbrushes and mirrors.
I saw that. It's very vital. One cannot live without a hairbrush. Did it have? Was it Victorian? Did it have Dickens' like signature on it?
No, it was
like,
only from the
60s. Like, or Taylor. No, it's not good enough. Maybe some Irish.
And a little hat brush, you know. But I also, I've also been engaging in a new local history class, PJ, on some Belfast history, kind of during Victorian times, and also.
I would have thought that's not Hispanic enough for you, though.
It's not, but it was always available, like, to be honest. Bottom of the barrel stuff, you know, Belfast. And then, of course, I've started my Mexican dance. I've got my first dance coming up this weekend, so I'm very excited about that. So keeping busy, but still bringing the content.
Very nice, Tim, very nice. So what other book has thou
favorites? Book. So I mentioned Unamuno, so he wasn't the second book I read, but let's just move on to him, and we'll do a logical sequence here.
Well, just the logical sequence is, dear listeners, that we're moving up ahead in time. Miguel de Unamuno is Generación de 98, 1898 generation, a critical generation, Dean, because this whole Spanish empire where the sun never sets had lost a territory in Cuba. There was a war in Cuba, and I believe in the Philippines and Guam, and they had to sell. So basically, Spain was very proud that they had an empire around the globe. But really, right at the end of the 19th century, they lost a lot of important territory, really silly mistakes. And they lost a lot of things. And really, Spain, really for the first time in a long time, well, really for the first time since the beginning of real Spain, started doubting that that's maybe not as grand
mm-hmm.
as they thought it was. And the authors reflect that. Whereas Galdós, I feel like, is still proud to be Spanish. He's very critical, as well as other authors of the society. But like Miguel de Unamuno really starts doubting. And Pío Baroja, for example, another 98, even more. Pío Baroja is like the most pessimistic, I find, of all of them. But Vian Inclán, who Dean has reviewed, and I also recommend. So in this generation, Dean, like, you're either really going against Spain or they're really focusing on just regionalism. They're saying, like, maybe Vian Inclán is, like, only focusing Galicia and it's not kind of F off Spain kind of thing. So a lot of negativity going on. But what did you think of Tía Tulia? I didn't read that one from Unamuno, but I mentioned the one that I have.
So I actually just finished this one today, but we'll get to it. I cheated this month because I still read a lot of books, but they were all shorter books. And the reason is because, to let the listeners in on a secret behind the curtain, we're recording a few days earlier than usual. And also, I didn't read during my holiday, so I actually missed like half of the month's reading. So I had to squeeze in a lot of small books.
Well, shame on you, Dean. Cheap tricks.
The shame. See, I don't have a booing sound effect because this is a happy sounds only that I've loaded
Ooh.
up. So.
Ooh.
Cheated. So La Tía Tula, Miguel de Unamuno. I'm going to say it was all right. I don't find his writing style to be as sophisticated as, say, Galdós.
Well, he doesn't try, yeah.
You know, and that put me off a little bit. Like, it was fine. I liked it, but I didn't love it, you know. It just didn't have that slightly higher kind of level of sophistication that I like. So basically we have La Tia Tula, that's kind of her nickname, Tula, but Gertrudis is her her full first name. Essentially her sister Rosa and then this chap Ramiro, they want to get together, so she kind of encourages them to get together. She's highly respected within the family, so she gives her opinion and says, yes, you should definitely get married. Even though you kind of wonder if maybe he would have preferred to marry her, but she's like, no, marry Rosa. Like, this is what's going to happen. And, you know, have kids. One of the things where it loses me is there's a bit of an inbuilt old-fashioned sexism where they constantly talk about, you know, essentially the role of a woman is to be a mother and reproduce. Like, that's it for these people, you know?
Yeah.
And the world is very small and very insular. It's all just the family in the home. You don't really see much outside influence. And even when there's lots of kids later, it's all just, what do we do with our lives? We raise the next ones and look after our brothers. Like, nothing's happening outside.
It's continuing the theme of Garados, right? Even though this is Garados' writing done before in the 70s, and Tia Tula would be perhaps, well, wouldn't that be maybe the very beginning of the 20th century? But anyway, I can't quite remember now the date.
I'll double check the date now. I had it earlier.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. See, when I Google Latia, there's a movie from the 60s, but the book was written in 1921.
Okay, fair enough.
But when I Google Tia Tula, I'm getting some kind of skincare product. So.
Well, you know, so really almost 50 years later, and they're sharing the theme, and it's a very big theme in Spain, this whole kind of like the city versus the rural area. And yeah, so he's discussing that, and I find like this generation is now making it more extreme. They're really even finding it more extreme. Yeah.
There's two completely different ways that you can read this book. Okay, and that's what's good about it. So one way is this poor lady. You know, she's trying to get this love match put together. She herself never gets married. Rosa dies quite early in the novel. She takes over raising the kids. She's very kind. She hangs out with the family. She's teaching them, you know, essentially her ways, but it's all she knows, right? About being, you know, good to their brothers, being good mothers and this kind of thing. And you can kind of read it that she's kind of selfless. But on the other hand, you can read it that maybe she's manipulative from the beginning and she's trying to get into this family. Like, all of a sudden, you know, there's a scene early on where Rosa says, like, now that I'm married, my husband's always busy. And she's like, yeah, or he invents things to be busy with. And then all of a sudden she starts turning up at the house every day and she's like, I'll help. And then she kind of takes over. And after Rosa dies, she's like, well, I'm the mother now. She keeps all constantly saying, I'm the mother. And the kids should call me mother. Don't call me aunt. Call me mama. Constantly in the book, you know? So you could kind of read it that maybe, and I didn't like her for most of the book. And I think I reconciled, you know, eventually, but I kind of read most of it in the second interpretation. I was only really at the end that I kind of wandered. So you could kind of see her as being not so great. And she has, again, this martyr, this self-sacrificing kind of like thing that she's imposing, just like in the last book, you know? But another interpretation is that she is a good person. I'm going to say, because I read a little bit about the movie, there's a big difference here. Because in the book, it's stated that he constantly, so after Rosa dies, the husband is always asking Tula to marry him next. And she says, no, I'm going to be your wife in the sense that I will live in the house with you and raise your children. But like, there's no relation between us, even though we like each other.
Yeah.
So he feels really kind of let down by this. And then even when he expresses interest in other women, she's like, no, you shouldn't do that. That's sinful. But I'm also not going to give you anything. And he's kind of like, in dire straits. Like in the movie, he rapes her, but that does not happen.
Okay, sorry.
Let me rephrase that. In the movie, he tries to.
The other way around. Okay.
No, in the movie, he tries to rape her, and then he rapes a relative instead. None of that happens in the book. Or maybe you're supposed to read a little more into it. He makes advances. She says no. He stops. You know, and that's it. He says, okay, then we're not going to get together. He then gets together with a 19-year-old kind of orphan girl. But it's never stated in the book that there's any kind of like sexual assault, violation, anything like that. But the movie maybe up the drama or something. I don't know.
Okay.
Because I was really confused when I read the movie script, and I went back and looked at my notes from the book, and I was like, no, it's not stated in the book, you know? But in the end, he does, you know, and he brings this other girl in, and they have more kids. So in the end, there's a lot of kids. One of the main themes is that she doesn't want to marry, because then if she has kids with him, she's afraid she'll not be as close with Rose's kids.
Right.
And she's like, then I'm like their stepmom, and I've got my own kid, you know. So that's like one of the themes in the book. So she just wants to keep things as they are, you know.
Right. Okay. So it's a book about maternity and all its aspects.
All about maternity. Yeah. Positives, negatives, and everything. And the guy, you know, it isn't really that important, to be honest. It is really all about her. And even after she's, you know, in the final scenes when we see the next generation and the kids are a bit older and they're looking after people, they're always still referencing her, even though she's, you know, gone by this point. So it's nice to kind of see that. And it was those scenes where I realized maybe she's not so bad, you know?
It reminds me of Ursula, the first mother figure of 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez, is also that big theme of family tradition and this one big imposing mother figure who, even after she dies, her persona still carries on.
I had to check, DJ, just real quick, when I saw the second generation come in, I had to double check that he wasn't Latin American, but...
that is a very Latin American thing to do. You know, Miguel de Unamuno, I read only one novella of his, which was, I think, his last one, San Manuel Bueno Mártir.
Saint
Emmanuel the Good Martyr. And, you know, that's just very, very small of it. It's more like a short story, but usually released by itself. I really recommend that book. Essentially, the theme is a priest who does not believe in God, but pretends that he believes in God in order to keep up Christian morality. And to keep up the Christian morality alive in the village. So he is a person that people look up to in order to keep up their faith, but not really keep up their faith, but to keep up their moral standard. He kind of sacrifices his own identity and just goes along with being a good Saint Manuel, and he's a martyr. But he's a martyr not because he's a martyr because he's sacrificing his own non-belief. And, Unamuno talks a lot about this, about spiritual loss, and and he says, like, well, he talks a lot about his books. He's a philosopher, so don't forget. So if his writing seems dry, it's because he is essentially a philosopher who also wrote a lot of philosophy books. And he talks about that the most tragic thing about life is simply that it will end. So that art is all about extending our life force. It's all about living beyond our physical capabilities, which can be an honorable thing. So Shakespeare lives on, or it could be just a almost futile, anxiety-ridden thing as well. So it depends which approach you want to take. But he is a type of unique existentialist, different though than Camus or Kierkegaard. He's not as nihilistic, I would say, or not as dramatic, I would say. He just tries to be more practical.
Mm-hmm.
And so that book really describes this philosophy as well.
And I should point out as well, just on what you said, religion plays a big part in this as well. And she's very religious and all this kind of stuff. She meets the priest regularly and tells him he's wrong about things because she's like, knows more than he does. You know, that's the idea.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of that. And she's kind of argumentative. And part of some of those aspects made me, you know, not like her, but... I don't like this kind of martyr, like I'm the victim, you know, kind of for that kind of manipulation. I don't really love, you know.
And what I like about the novella San Manuel Bueno is that doesn't really ever do that. Doesn't do self pity, and it's a very simple story, and you don't really see much insight to his thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But there are two things I just want to trivia, if you don't mind, Dean. I really like Unamuno as a person, though. I think he's got a very interesting. There are a lot of interesting stories that are sometimes contradictory about him. Now, he's essentially a philosopher teacher, right? So that's one thing that you probably like. A bit different than the others of his generation. People, but, you know, Weinklein is like really this bohemian, long-bearded fellow. Whatever. Pio Baroja is this really kind of like negative person really, in his Arbo de la Ciencia. That's a really depressing book. But Unamuno was really I think slightly older than Duration. He was a bit of an outsider then. Philosophy teacher from Salamanca, I believed. And here are a few things I find interesting. He was exiled. He was exiled and put into imprisoned inside of his own house. That's how controversial it was for the government of his time. And I don't think really anyone liked him from the politics, because he was definitely an anti-fascist, definitely. Mm-hmm. But he kind of also, I think, supported Franco at the beginning, just right. At the beginning. So there are a few things that were, but essentially was a Republican against the Franco section. And he was exiled into Fuerteventura, the island beside me. And of course, he wrote a lot of bad things about the Canary Islands. So I obviously have some mixed feelings about him, because I feel that he only disliked Fuerteventura because he was forced to stay on that island. Because really, being forced to be in an island full of sun, is that really so tragic, Dean?
Like, you know? I would like to undergo this punishment.
But anyway, he was, and at the end of his life, there was a big discussion he had with a politician, basically a fascist. And he knew it was the end. He knew he died just before the Spanish Civil War, I think, really started, or just at the beginning started. He died in 1936. But he already said, convenceréis. No, sorry. Venceréis, pero no convenceréis. You will beat us. You will be victorious in your battle, but you will never convince us.
Yeah.
And I think this is interesting, because he foreshadowed the whole Franco era, where he knew they were going to win, but no one was ever really convinced by mm-hmm. Francoism and by any dictatorship, right? I thought that's a brilliant phrase. Venceréis, pero no convenceréis. It also rhymes.
It's good, yeah.
So I thought that was awesome. Epic, yeah.
But I want to mention one thing real quick before we move on. Guys, get over to patreon.com/booksboys. And as I say, for £2.50 or €3, $3, here's what we've released since the last episode. We did Film Fellows, V for Vendetta. We did two episodes of Dark Place Dreamers, where Robert and I reviewed The Sandman. We released two episodes of Playboys Extra, PJ. We did The Importance of Being Earnest with Alex. And also, we did an Inspector Calls, and with Mireia, I did La Fundación, the Antonio Guerrero Vallejo play. So actually three episodes of Playboys this month. So that's a crazy amount of stuff. Go and get it.
Oh, yeah.
The facts that will be presented are true.
Yes, PJ.
Hello there.
Dean, as always, joined by Mireia. Say hello.
Hello.
Dark Place Robert and Playboy Alex.
Doing all right. Glad to be here again.
So I've given you those nicknames. I'm not a fan of that one. Well, that's where people will know you from.
Nobody's
that's why
going to know me from that one, but let's carry on anyway.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Join us for Shakespeare written, Spanish plays and poetry, rock star interviews, film reviews, Dark Place Dreamers, and more. Patreon.com/booksboys. There we go, guys. You can get us on the Patreon. And just mentioning Alex and Robert, it would such a shame that we don't have them here to celebrate our anniversary with us, you know?
Ah, such a pity, isn't it?
Hold on a second, PJ. I think we're getting a call here. I'm just looking at my old-fashioned caller ID. It says the call's coming from the Playboy Mansion. Let's see, just setting aside. Who have we got on the line here? You got Dean and PJ on Books Boys.
Hey, it's Alex.
Oh my God, it's Playboy Alex. There
oh
we go.
God.
Wow.
Our mutual friend.
Our mutual friend, Playboy Alex.
How are you doing there?
Not too bad. We're just we're working our way through our through our 2-year anniversary episode. Well,
the thing is, we've realized, Alex, you know, Spanish and Italian. Oh!
The crowd, they are applauding us, PJ.
Exactly. We're celebrating Spanish and Italian literature, because so far we haven't discovered any other kind of book. We'll see if someone comes up with something else. But what about yourself, Alex? What are you up to?
Oh, you know, just hanging out in the Playboy Mansion.
That's it, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Petting the bunnies. That's what they know.
I heard a rumor, Alex, that you have been reading a Shakespeare. Not Shakespeare. You are reading a Shakespeare. You've been reading a Dickens. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, Shakespeare, Dickens, no. All the same. Yeah, here and there.
There is English literature out there. But you'll have to call back in and discuss
I will
that
tell you
one
about that,
when
yes.
the when you finish it. Yeah.
Congratulations on 2 years.
Well, thank you very much. But hold on a second. PJ, we're getting another call from the Dreamscape. Let's see who's calling in from the
Parallel
Dreamscape.
Universe.
Hello there. You got Dean and PJ and Alex and Alfred and everyone on the line.
Who's this?
I love how you have a phone that works for two distinct callers at the same time and can, you know, host that whole time.
You never heard what of the four-way calling?
He's heard of four ways.
But... not on the old rotor phone, no. I imagine you
Robert,
still
have
this rotor phone.
But this is metaphysics now.
Robert. Hi, how are you getting
we
on?
Got
congratulations
Robert.
On 2 years.
Awesome, thank you very much. I need to get distinct ringtones, so it's going to be like, you know, some kind of spooky Dark Place theme for Robert, and then it'll be like some kind of sexy theme for Playboy Alex, you know.
I thought I had a distinct
Can we switch those?
Theme song. Nope.
Switch them, yeah, we could do that.
We could do indeed. So we got all the cool kids in the block.
We got everyone awesome. Here. And Robert, I hear that you are also reading a Dickens.
No.
Oh, yeah, but... no, I've just finished A Christmas Carol there. And funnily enough, it's currently celebrating Diwali. So it's a very, very festive time for myself altogether. At the wrong time, just creeping up onto Halloween as well. I feel very gluttonous at the moment. But yeah, so most of the time, I just read books to spice Dean. I'm going to read his favourite book and pick hold.
Oh no!
And I was devastated to find out that this was a perfect book.
Yes,
it was just magical. I'll still hold that the Muppets movie adaptation is still the best Christmas Carol movie, but the actual book, I was blown away by actually.
Good. Now, did we see this? I saw this in the theater with both of you. Did we all see this? Alex,
we did see it in the theater. Art? Yes, Belfast.
Yeah,
Grand
I
Opera House.
So. A year ago, to be fair.
Oh, but, yeah. Yes, I remember this. We went to the Grand Opera House and we actually saw a play live adaptation. I was very disappointed with the Ghost of Christmas Future in that particular adaptation. Because it was always a very creepy, even in the book, it does an amazing job on producing this weird creature. And no, it was quite disappointing in the play. But my favorite part of the entire book is, you know, grabbing onto the Ghost of Christmas Past and the hood falls back and you expect, what are you expecting? Oh, it's a bedpost. It's fine.
So, like, I guess we all know the book, you know, we all know the story, whether we've read it or seen it or whatever. So we don't need to get into too much detail. But what, you know, you've said about your favorite parts. Was there anything you didn't like about it?
No, actually, I just devoured the book. I was reading through it, constantly nearly missing my tube stops because I didn't want to put it down. you know, just nearly being late for work and nearly lost my job over this book. It was that good.
That's what we hope for, you know.
The similes, the pacing, the themes, everything was just perfect and spot on. Even the concept of the ghost Marley, and it's not done any justice in any movie I've seen of this, but the concept that Marley was sitting me, it's a spooky and festive thing all wrapped up into one. And I don't know why, but that seems to make, you know, the Christmas time, the Christmas magic, all the more magical, knowing that there's some sort of horrors out there. These, I don't know, Santa Claus, Cthulhu things.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, yeah.
Cool. Well, guys... I don't want to take up too much of everyone's time, but I want to say that we're so happy to be here on our party episode. And yay, the party horn.
Woo!
And thanks so much for taking the time to call in. Alex, we'll have to get another chat with you when you finish your Dickens as well.
Yes.
I got to say, I love your crowd because they just disappear very quickly. As fast as they show up, they're just gone.
I've muted their mic.
But they're actually partying on, exactly. Non-stop.
But we should all remember to mute them. Keep calm and read our Dickens.
Hi, PJ and Dean. This the Speak Up Sis lady, Angel Charmaine, calling in all the way from Augusta, Georgia in the U.S.,
just wanting to say happy 2-year anniversary. You two are amazing. Continue doing what you're doing. You are inspiring a whole new generation to read, and I appreciate that. Take care and blessings on a year 3
for you. And I just want to go back to Unamuno. I know I've been going on about him, but there's one more thing I'd like to mention. Unamuno was considered among the Spanish academics a specialist on Portuguese literature. I know this seems very random, but stick with me. You know, Unamuno made a point that as a Spanish person who loves literature, he really wanted to get into Portuguese and Catalan literature, Iberian literature.
Right.
And really no Spanish person I know ever reads Portuguese literature. Mm. Like Saramago maybe, but it's just, I feel that the whole concept of if you want to understand your neighbor, read their literature makes complete sense.
Sure.
Obviously, it's nice to read some Japanese, US literature, but maybe if you're Swedish and you're not getting along well with your Danish or Latvian neighbor, why not read the literature? So that's just something I just want to add.
I'm confused, BJ, because I was under the impression that they only wrote books in Spanish.
Yes, that is confusing. So what is Portuguese? All that stuff, yeah. And talking about that, Dean, but I have read an Italian play.
Oh, wow.
So, obviously, there are at least Italian plays, and we're moving on to...
Well, hold on, sorry, PJ, does that mean I need to redo our branding? I was going to rename us from Books Boys to Chicos de los Libros. Have I got to change that? Because you've told me that there's more than just Spanish literature right there.
Well, this is very confusing, right? Because I thought that's all it is, Spanish literature, right? People mentioned Dickens and Shakespeare, but I think those are brands.
Guillermo Shakespeare, I've heard of, yeah.
Well, maybe, yeah, Guillermo, that makes more sense, yeah. But we're not moving ahead in time, we're actually sticking with the time. Contemporary, I think he was even, let me get this straight, I believe he was born and died on the same year as Miguel de Unamuno. And I'm just going to double check that. And I'm talking about... Oh, no. Okay. Miguel Unamuno was born in 1864 and died in 1936. I'm talking about Luigi Pirandello, who was born 3 years later, 67, and died in 1936 as well. Now, Luigi Pirandello, a Nobel Prize winner of 1934, for, quoting, his almost magical power to turn psychological analysis into good theater, unquote. Luigi Pirandello is famous nowadays as a playwright, as basically the quintessential playwright, as long as the second playwright Nobel Prize winner, Dario Fo, in the 90s.
Right.
But Luigi Pirandello came first. Essentially absurdism, but a prototype of absurdism, still some coherency. Now, I know you're not too fond of Waiting for Godot, Dean.
Not too fond. Those were the mild words that I used when we read that play.
Well, I love Waiting for Godot, and I love Ionesco, and I love all these absurdist plays. Pirandello is not an absurdist, though, I would say. He just uses a lot of absurdist traits and a lot of, yes, I suppose, a lot of meta literature as well. So he's famous for a play called Six Characters in Search of the Author. I was just basically just the way it sounds, just looking for the author. But I read the play written straight after that, I believe 1922, I believe. So really, we're talking about the same time period as La Tia Tula. And this play is called Henry the... Oh, am I getting confused now? Henry the Fourth.
Henry the Fourth, right.
Indeed. And do not quake in your boots, Dean. It's really an historical play a la Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I only like my Henrys when they come in six parts.
Well, indeed you do, yeah. So it isn't, I'm afraid, that. Essentially, Enrico y Cuarto is not an historical play at all. It's a modern play. It's about someone who believes he is Henry IV, as in Henry IV, the emperor of 11th century Germany and then Italy as well. So a real person, but essentially the story is quite simple. They enter, well, we're in a setting that looks like a palace, but for some reason there's also like a butler who appears in modern, at least the 1920s clothing. And we got like these four chaps who are dressed in 11th century clothes, and they're kind of saying, what are you doing? You can't be wearing this. What if Enrico sees you? What if the king sees you? Mm-hmm. The emperor. And it says like, what we, and the butler's like, oh, what are you doing? But they're like, no, go away, go away. They are playing an act. So the actors are acting in the play. This is very Pirandello-esque, meta.
Right.
And they are doing this because Enrico, doing a carnival or kind of a carnival festival, fell down off his horse while playing the part of Henry VI. And when he awoke, he believed he was Henry VI and basically lives in his head in the 11th century. So that's what it's all about. But let me go, let me just take a step back a bit. It doesn't begin with Enrico the Fourth or Henry the Fourth. It begins with some characters that Henry the Fourth knew. So this is what's a bit confusing, and reading it in Italian was like, I think there's some Sicilian words. He's a Sicilian, so it's a bit different.
Right, a wee bit, yeah.
It's quite difficult, but I managed. And it starts off with confusing, though, not just because of language. It's confusing because it does start off like a historical play, but then there's like a butler, and these historical figures do appear that existed in the 11th century. So you got Lady Matilda Spina. This is very important. Because she was kind of an arch enemy of Henry. Yet it's implied that maybe Henry the Fourth was in love with her, but the reason why she is an arch enemy is because she supported the Pope, whereas Henry the Fourth at the time was trying to get trying to go against the Pope. That's essentially the reason.
Right.
And the Pope doesn't exist in the play, but he's a constant threat, an outsider threat. A big theme in the play is like non-existing threats. Like just this kind of paranoia that's really in Henry the Fourth inside, but also in the other characters, I feel. So we've got Lady Matilda Spina. We got the four figures that are kind of like, you know, kind of like the special service of the emperor. And they're more like comic relief. So we got Lady Matilda Spina. We got Frida, her daughter. We got the Baron Tito Belcredi, Matilda's kind of lover, just not sure. We've got also De Nolli, who's married, Frida, the daughter of Lady Matilda. And we've got the doctor as well. And the doctor is really this kind of like ultra scientific figure, kind of, I feel like he's kind of foreshadowing some kind of fascist kind of ideology, this kind of really practical, we're going to analyze this person, dissect. He wants to dissect Henry the Fourth. He wants to really psychoanalyze him, even though he doesn't use that word. But really, apart from the doctor, everyone's acting a part, and it does become clear after a while that they know that they're not these historical figures. They're just really acting, but they're really into their part as well. And essentially, the play is about them really being scared of what they're doing, but playing along with Henry the Fourth. And when Henry the Fourth appears, he reacts very crazily, I would say. Right from the beginning, he shows respect and then disrespect from one nanosecond to the next. And what I do like about this play is that Henry the Fourth does give some interesting pessimistic world insights in the sense of Hamlet, it reminded me of, or maybe Richard III. So it does become Shakespearean in the speeches, I would say.
Okay.
But for me, I have a problem with the length. It's a long play, 90 pages, and it's too much, I feel like. And I feel like there's not enough action, like in the sense of Hamlet, at least, was more like...
Compare the length of Shakespeare, because Shakespeare's are pretty long anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, no, it isn't as... Yeah, it's probably as long as a short Shakespeare play, but Shakespeare does... Shakespeare is entertaining. No, it is though. Like, you know what I mean? Like, okay. And
in this guy, we're not like, sure, right?
Well, with Pirandello, I feel like it's a bit too much into the whole philosophy and psychoanalysis, and that's interesting. I think I would have enjoyed this play more when I was a teenager and I was reading more Freud and Marx and all those fellows. I would have enjoyed more of a story, but I do enjoy the writing style. I can't imagine it being translated. I'd love to see it translated, but it's beautiful Italian. And very interesting concepts about time, about life. So Henry IV has a line in it. I'm not really quoting, this is by memory actually. He says something along the lines of that tomorrow would be just like today, and then the next day will be just like today. We are just continuing on, and we think, he gives an interesting metaphor with like, just when we think that we're holding on to our lives like serpents, the serpents slide away from our hands and things disappear. And so it becomes an ultra pessimistic, depressing play, to be honest. It's not enjoyable.
That's not your kind. That's not the kind that you like.
It's not dark lit. Let's be honest. It's not dark lit. No, Sue's here.
The king of literature, our good friend, Dr. Seuss.
Dr. Theodore.
Recall to last month, that's all.
Oh, Lord. But I'm afraid he isn't Dr. Seuss. But Pirandello, yeah, highly recommend him. Similar to Unamuno, wasn't clearly an anti-fascist, but he did support definitely Mussolini at the beginning. But he kind of soon realized Mussolini was a madman, as most people did eventually realize, obviously. However, he did controversially give his Nobel Prize medal to the Mussolini government to be turned into material to build things. Kind of crazy. But on the other hand, he refused. Mussolini offered that he would pay his funeral when he died, and he refused that. So he refused to have a Mussolini funded funeral. To note just a few interesting things, his Pirandello's wife became crazy after like a financial crisis. He actually grew up in a well established family, Pirandello, rich family, but they lost a lot of money when one of their sulfur mines became inundated. And his wife kind of had a nervous breakdown and never recuperated. So, and it really affected Pirandello because he would just kind of, he would work hard and write, but then at nighttime, he just kind of take care of a just rambling woman, actually,
right,
who had to be taken. And she had to be, she was put into an asylum at the end, but it really affected his life. And Pirandello started off as a novelist, short story writer. And he only really started writing these quintessential plays late in his career, like I think in his 50s, so around the 1920s, just after she was put into an asylum. So I think maybe it's always like a homage or to his wife, or at least him dealing with the pains he must have had. So he obviously observed madness, and I think it was difficult for him. So he had to write about madness. It's a difficult play to read. You do feel the pain, but I do recommend it for its concepts. And
do you? I'm not convinced that you do recommend it.
I do recommend it if you're in a right state of mind. I find it a bit depressing. I thought like I wanted my Dr. Seuss after a while reading it.
Yeah,
but I was really enjoying the beginning. You see, and I really loved the characters. I thought it was he has a unique ways of describing characters even physically, which I thought like, okay, this is like no person could look like this. He makes one of them look like a bird as well. And I thought that's very Dr. Seuss-esque. I like that.
Okay.
So Pirandello, quintessential playwright. It's been translated into English by Tom Stoppard. So it's a well-regarded translation. Don't forget, he's a very famous British playwright. So very much respect it. Just not my doc-lit Dr. Seuss material, which I like now.
All right. Well, back to me. PJ, this one, unfortunately, our other Patreon co-host, well, we did a few things. We're finished with them now. Mireia wasn't able to be here for our anniversary, but she did send me this book, Ramon J. Sender, Requiem por un Campesino Español. I believe you've heard of this book.
Another Spanish classic, yeah. We're moving on slightly ahead in time. I believe this would be maybe the early 50s, late 40s.
Yeah, and we have this signed here. I'll show you this later, but it's signed to ourselves, to Dean and PJ, to enjoy the book and a hug from the vice president of El Batiath. So if you go to elbatiath.es, it's a Spanish website, obviously. This is an association, Asociación Cultural El Batiath. And what they're doing, obviously, they're in this town, Tauste, which is in Aragon. And that's why they sent this particular book, because it's set in an unknown town in Aragon. And obviously, with me having been in Zaragoza, I was just in Aragon. And I got to
see. And I just want to mention to the listeners. And I want to mention, listeners, my dad has a country house in Aragon, so I would spend most of my summers there. So I'm very fond of Aragon, indeed.
I would like my congratulations to PJ and Dean, the book boys. Their blogs have given me a lot of pleasure over the past 2 years. When I think about PJ and Dean, I'm reminded of Oliver Goldsmith's words about the village schoolmaster in his epic poem, The Deserted Village. And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew, that one small head could carry all he knew. Well, in the cases of Dean and PJ, two average-sized heads. But you get my drift. Keep up the good work, boys.
So, I haven't read this novel, though. I only know about it.
Okay. Well, basically, they are... This society's purpose is to promote Tauste, right? Just the culture, history, and that kind of thing. And they do good work, so check them out. Wow. And they've kindly given us this book with a lovely message inside.
That's so nice.
Requiem for a Spanish Peasant, I guess, is a translation for Campesino, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is short. I mean, this lovely version comes with a lot of introduction, a lot of other notes, but the actual book itself is about 75 pages.
Have you noticed that most Spanish books by now have like really long introductions by academics? They love that kind of thing.
Yeah,
I like that they do that, because not so. I like that they take it so seriously that they have to get some academic specialists talking as long about the book as the books on this.
I think it's 50-50, like intro and actual book.
But the Unamuno book I got was from Catedral. I love Letras Catedral because they're really kind of academic. And like really, the introduction was longer than the novella.
Wow.
It was longer. So, I mean, sometimes it's like that. But so, yeah, tell me about it.
What we have in this one is, I mean, look, it's really nice. And it's nice to see, obviously, something set in Aragon where I just was and where we now both have good memories. But it is short. So, you know, you're not going to get a huge amount of kind of character development, but essentially it's a tale. So we have this guy Mossen Mijan, and he has to do a requiem for a chap who has died, and Paco, and he's going to do this service, and in the meantime he's just kind of reflecting. So this is a book of reflection where he's thinking about Paco's life, because he knew him from birth to death. So he's reflecting on the life of this boy. And we have some kind of flashback scenes with the boy. We have some modern scenes with the chap, Mossen, kind of just thinking and reflecting. And he's kind of not banging his head off the wall, but he's kind of, well, lightly banging his head off the wall to the point where there's a mark where he's always kind of in the same spot.
Which supposedly Mussolini used to do to his fellow classmates. Just a little link to Mussolini.
And the third interesting thing is, there's a boy who's just working there, like in the church or whatever, you know, helping out. And he comes in and out, but he's always kind of singing and humming this kind of ballad while he comes in and out and goes about his work. But the lyrics, although it's just a made up little song or whatever, the lyrics always kind of give you little insights into the parts of the story that you're on as well. So it all kind of links up. So it's very superbly crafted.
Okay. Interesting.
It's very well written. But to give a quick rundown, you know, on the story. So this guy Paco seems like a really, really lovely kid. So one of the first things they do is, you know, Mossen takes him out. He says, you know, his parents allow him to take him out, and he kind of goes on his rounds. He's doing his kind of religious duties in the town, you know. And he sees this one family, and he's very sad. He kind of says no one's coming to see them and no one's helping them and they're poor. And he makes this initial immediate strong connection, like, why aren't we helping these people, you know? And Mohsen, whilst he's a good guy, I guess he's old and he's seen a lot of this. And he's like, look, there's poor people even in the next town. Like, there's nothing special about this family, you know? But the kid is like, but they're poor and they clearly need help. And he's just a nice person. And he has a little bit of the naivete, of course. But he kind of wants to see, well, what can we do to help them? And then he says, well, actually, their son could have helped, but he's in jail. So that, it's like, okay, maybe, are they good people? Well, yeah, we think they're good people, just the son did something bad. And, you know, so they're trying to teach a little bit about morality to the kid as well, you know? Which is nice. And he gives his, you know, they talk about the sermon. And he talks about, like, the kiss of Judas and all these kind of, like, dramatic titles for some of the sermons that he's doing. But what's really interesting about the boy is they say, what do you want to be? Would you like to be a priest? Would you like to be a general in the army? You know, what do you want to do? And he says, I want to be a laborer like my dad. And he glorifies this kind of peasantry, you know? And he's like, yeah, that's all I want to do. And they talk about, what if the king gets chased away and we kind of bring in this revolution? And he's kind of like, well, I don't care who the king is. I care if the crops grow. And if the you know, the vines are growing and we're going to have wine and whatever else. So he's really very agriculturally minded. He doesn't care about the, you know, politics, the big sphere kind of things. He's just like, yeah, well, what's happening in the day-to-day with these crops and these poor people? You know,
so kind of like a Hemingway approach to The Old Man and the Sea, kind of glorifying the non-intellectual, in a sense, you know, kind of glorifying the person who deals with land and the sea directly with his hands.
Yeah, it's nice to glorify that, because probably we don't see that enough, especially in the books I read.
Well, because authors write about what they know about. They usually write about other authors or intellectuals, whatever. So it's nice to see that too.
Yeah, but I like it because it's someone who's a bit simplistic but lovely, you know. And I'll give you an example of the naivete. They're talking about the kind of family and things, and they say, "Well, the son was maybe not so good." And he says, "Well, was he bad?" And he says, "Well, look, he can't have been that bad." I say, "Well, why not?" I say, "Because if he was that bad, they wouldn't be poor. He would have stolen money for them." So again, he's kind of using this child logic, but it's like, it does also make sense, you know?
Yeah, I like it. Okay, that's the book I'd like to read, actually.
And it's short, it's accessible. I'm not going to spoil too much about the ending, but I will just kind of hint that the boy does eventually get into some trouble, okay? Some legal difficulties, and it's sad. Let's just put it that way. And now that's why Mohsen is having to reflect on his life and do this requiem.
And don't forget Ramon Sender, he also fought in the Civil War. So we're talking a lot about that. These are authors were more or less the same time period. Now he's later than Unamuno or than Pirandello. Mm-hmm. But he was in the Spanish Civil War. His wife was murdered in the Civil War. He had to escape Spain because Franco, you know, wouldn't have him. You know, he was forced to be in the USA and forced to, like, sign an anti-communist manifesto because otherwise, but he wasn't against the communists, obviously. He was more of a socialist. Mm. So he was forced to do things, forced to, had a tough life. You know, he couldn't really come back to Spain until Franco died, you know, so.
Yeah,
obviously, he had to have like a pessimistic ending, or maybe even glorify a bit that what he misses about Aragon being—he himself was Aragonese, so he probably missed that kind of person. Mm-hmm. Maybe some part of him wanted to wish that he had been that, right, become like this intellectual, politically involved writer. Yeah.
So just to mention, it's 1953. I just looked up the exact year for us.
Yeah,
And just to be clear, the working title was Mohsen Mijan, which is the chap's name. But they changed the title because they didn't want to, or Sender didn't want to focus on him. He wanted to make it more about the boy. So that's why the title was changed.
Written in the US, just to make clear. He's already in exile at that point, then missing the Aragonese home.
Yeah. honestly, it's lovely. And there's other characters, you know, there's one lady, La Jerónima, and she's kind of always, there's these usual tales of morality, but like, why is she always single? And they kind of, she kind of says, well, I'm always single, but, you know, I still meet some men around the back of the buildings and this kind of thing. And there's like a little bit of kind of shock about that. And, you know, this kind of stuff. And they tell the boy, like, during Holy Week, don't go over there where the women bathe because they gossip, and we got to avoid these gossiping women. They're saying all sorts of things, you know. So there's a little bit of that kind of stuff thrown in as well. But
and what I like about this generation now, the post-Spanish Civil War generation, just like Antonio Buero Vallejo, you mentioned earlier with La Fundación, you know, his first play, I think it was, The Story of a Staircase, which I love, also has these very raw, crude characters. Like sexuality, for example, is way more openly discussed from now on. You know, you wouldn't have Unamuno or like Gados talk about that yet. But now it's starting to really come out. And really, but this is still very brave, because we're not really in a more liberated area. The contrary, like it's Franco era. So if anything, Spain has become even more conservative once again.
Sure.
But these people in exile are going against the government, really want to talk about sex, politics, and tragedy in the Civil War.
Without spoiling the ending, I do want to give one little hint, because there's a powerful thing for me. Because this boy's kind of trusted Mossen the whole time, you know, and taking advice from him. And things all go badly at the end, you know. And he says, but Mossen, you told me that this is what would happen, and that's not what's happening. And I feel like I've been tricked. And Mossen says, well, I was tricked too.
Mm.
And it's kind of, oh, this kind of respected guy that I've kind of taken the advice for, I've gone along with what he's telling me, but, you know, he was also misled, and now it's worked out badly for everyone. And then, of course, Mossen feels guilty for the outcome of things, but, you know, you can put trust in someone, but no one's infallible.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well,
so that is that one, Requiem for a Spanish Peasant.
Not Requiem for a Dream, the Hubert Selby novel. Very different, as well as the film.
Yeah.
This is Requiem for a Spanish Peasant.
Well, I think. Going to just remind everyone once again to check out patreon.com/booksboys and check out, you know, Film Fellows, Playboys. There's as many episodes of Playboys as there are Books Boys, if not more. There's a lot of stuff on
more,
there.
I think, yeah.
PJ, yeah. You got your piano there real quick. I think we're going to sing a song about our Patreon, just improvised.
All right, let's do it.
See what we can manage here.
Everybody, does Books Boys got an extra 100 episodes or more on Patreon? It only costs €3 to hear us every day for a month.
What?
And you'll never be lonely, because you always hear voices, and you always hear about Dickens, Balzac, and Tolstoy method.
Woo!
And I hope that you don't mind that I wrote this little song for you, because we created an episode just for you.
Just
for come on, Dean.
Just I hope for you.
Playboys is Patreon
for $3 to pounds 50 or something similar in euros
in the European zone.
Get it by a book.
So guys, get on the Patreon, just live, improvised, you know. That's
oh yeah, completely
with harmonies and everything.
Back then, yeah.
Well, let's move on to the second last book, the next book that I read. I don't know if you heard of this chap, PJ. I was thinking, like, who do we need to hear more about on the show? And there's two people that I really wanted to hear about. I thought, I don't know anything about this book called Discovery of Heaven. So I thought if anyone could tell me about that, just for an extended period of time. But I thought maybe we'll get to that another time. And today I'll read something by this chap, Alexandre Dumas. So I don't know if you...
I think you mispronounced his name. I think his name is Alejandro Dumas.
Alejandro Dumas. Well, funny you should say that, because although this is supposedly French, my copy is in Spanish.
Well, I believe all literature is written in Spanish. Isn't that what we're learning today?
That is
or is it later back in Spanish? Or
that's what I've been led to believe, yeah.
you know, people might write in other languages, but they just before they publish, they get someone else to just lay it back into Spanish. Yeah.
So with Dumas, it's always tricky, right? So I've got this book called El Caballero de Harmental. Okay, the Knight of Harmental, Le Chevalier, if you will. Couldn't find this any reference to this in English, of course.
Of course, though.
But it turns out it's easier than sometimes. They did release it. They just changed the title. In English, it's called The Conspirators.
Have you ever considered just looking up your original French title and then looking up what the book is? I think that's easier trying to like find the Spanish, English translations, especially from his older novels.
Yeah, maybe. Well, the English, again, this is a standalone, so at least we don't have to deal with, is it part 5 of 7 or part 6 of 8 and all this? But it's
part 10, 20.
Yeah, sometimes it's part 9, but in the other series it's part 3, you know. But you get a quarter of it and then it cut into a different book. But this was a standalone book. It was all right. it was not great.
You know, then you started off with loving Duma, and now, like, the enthusiasm has waned.
The further I go, I know. So basically, the reason the English title is called The Conspirators is because there is a conspiracy to overthrow the regime and the monarchy and everything, and Harmental is one of the ringleaders of that. I'm going to say very little about that because it's really boring. The bits I cared about was the love story. And now you may be shocked to hear this.
I'm very shocked. I just don't know what to say, David. You in love stories?
So,
is that really your thing?
Apparently so. We do have Harmental involved in a love story. And
did you say Harvey Keitel?
Harmental.
All right, not Harvey Keitel. Okay, just to get that clear. All right.
So there's this chap, Bouvard, and he takes in a girl who's essentially an orphan. Now there's a really sad scene. It's almost Balzacian. This girl's mother dies and the mother's cold, and friend Bouvard calls around to see what's going on, knowing that she's sick, you know, to check in. And the men come to take the furniture. They leave the corpse and the little girl, and they just take the furniture because it was rented. And he says, "What are you doing?" And they say, "Well, this furniture's not going to pay for itself, so we're taking it back. She's dead. She's not paying for it anymore." And he's horrified. Wow. That, like, that was their only thought, you know? The capitalist thought was their only thought.
Wow, okay. Well, it starts up very, very
and
powerful.
The little girl is like, you know, my mummy's really cold and she's not waking up. And it's sad, you know? And eventually this guy, Bouvard, says, "Do you know what? I'm going to adopt you." And like, not officially, like he always calls himself her teacher. But he does admit that he couldn't do without her. And he takes her in and they live together despite some scandal, like, oh, this teenage girl living with this older man. And he's like, "Look, I'm her teacher. I'm going to teach her. And that's all we're doing, you know?" And we have a familial bond, nothing romantic. And she tries to call him, you know, father and things like that. And he kind of says, "Look, that's not what we are, you know?" And then she starts to do some drawings to make money. And there's all these scenes that I love where he's like, "No, you can't, you know, you come from a noble family originally. You can't sully yourself by doing work of any kind." She's like, "I like doing the drawings." And he's like, "Well, you shouldn't be doing any kind of work because you're better than that, you know?" And he spends all of his money and every penny he can get to rent this nice place with a garden for her so that she'll be happy.
Hold on, she does the drawing. I understood he does the drawing.
No, so she's doing the drawing and she has to get the maid to go sell them because he's not happy, like, sullying her hand with work, you know? He kind of almost works that way. He works for the king in the library, actually, but he hasn't been paid in 6 years. But he's just continuing to go to work, you know, to do his work. And he says, like, "There's not a lot of work to do. I have a lot of free time." So he starts doing a second job where he's doing, like, copying. You know, you'll bring documents for him to copy or whatever.
Yeah.
And he copies some, and they're in a different language. I think they're actually in Spanish. And he copies some documents, which, of course, turn out to be traitorous documents relating to the conspirators. And then he gets himself in a spot of bother. And they take him, they lock him up temporarily, but just for a couple of days. They don't really put him in prison. They more like lock him up and tell him, "Copy this out and give us a copy of it. And it's going to take you a few days, but you can't leave until you do it." You know, just like luxury prison in a palace, you know. And he eventually does it. And he's very naive, and he's like, yeah, I'm nothing special. And of course, these high lords, they say, look, we owe you one. So he comes back later to get the one that they owe him, you know, to get his favor back. Right. And all he wants is to help his pupil, something to help his pupil. And they're like, who are you? He's like, don't you remember? I was here like 2 days ago and you said you owed me. Like, if you ever set foot in this palace again, we will kill you. He's like, right. So it's just like the ungratefulness of like the aristocracy, you know. But this nice. He's not a simpleton. Like, he does work in the king's library and things, but he's just trusting, and he's a nice, lovely person, and he's willing to take this girl in. But of course she falls in love. And originally the girl's like, I will never marry anyone, teacher, because I just want to stay with you and we're so happy, yay. And then she falls in love with Harmon Tal, just like, oh, hold on, this guy's handsome.
With Harvey Keitel.
With Harmon Tal.
All right, okay.
I don't know who Harvey Keitel is.
Okay.
So she falls in love with Harmon Tal, and of course he's the lead conspirator, and then it all starts to unravel. And he, of course, wasn't it her own teacher who translated the documents that expose Harmon Tal? And all this kind of stuff is unraveling, and everyone's getting in trouble, and you know what's gonna happen, and he's arrested, and all this kind of stuff. So it all goes to a big crescendo. But I care more about the romantic tale than I do about the conspirator's tale, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, well, I'm more interested in the old man's tale. That's fun. That I really like the beginning of that story. There's a lot of potential there.
The old man just a nice character, and he is naive, you know. He always thinks like, well, why would they be interested in me, you know? But he's just got himself tangled in this kind of web now, and he kind of wants to not be involved, you know. He just wants to go back to like living with his pupil and just being a teacher and being nice, you know.
Well, I do like the plot a lot more than most of the other Dumas books even that you mentioned, but you didn't find it so good, because why?
Well, it was good. It's just that the bits with the conspirators, which is like the middle third, it's kind of dull. It just gets political for like a third of the book. And I'm like, where's the romance, you know?
I agree with you, actually, in this case. I think it's the other part sounds way more interesting than the conspirators part.
Yeah. So the whole time I was just thinking, get back to this lovely story that you've presented me with.
But it's
almost that Anna Karenina method of just inserting something else in the middle, and it just takes up a lot of space. And I'm like, totally. I don't want this bit.
and was this serialized? Was he? Because I feel like often with these stories, like with Dickens, not that they're amazing authors, but I feel like sometimes they're obviously pressured both by time and obviously Dickens at least did. My
Dickens
dad told me that
was, yeah.
No, but Dickens also said, according to my dad, that he did change the storyline according to what the most people thought was the best. So did Dumas do something similar, or do you feel
not that I knew of. I don't know if they were serializing novels in France the way they were in England. I suppose I can't be sure, you know. But I'm not going to say very much at all else about it. It's a nice one. It's the longest book I read, because it was like a 300-pager. It was a proper book, not a novella, you know. But the rest of the books I read were quite short. But some of the romance between the... Harmon Tal's first name is Raoul, so that'll make things less confusing for our friend Harvey. The little notes they write to each other are very nice, and he gets a little bit coquettish at times with him, which, you know, I love. But this man can't believe. He's like, why would they want to speak to me? He's like, well, only because you're involved in high treason. He's like, what? Like, I translated those documents, you know? It's a nice one, though. It is lovely, and I wouldn't say it's as good as, you know, the classic Dumas, but it might be worth you know, checking out get the chance. Yeah. If you've liked the good ones, then go check this out. So,
planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.